on making sure that that advice that was accepted by the board was implemented. So we've been focused on that fight some time. Bobby's going to speak a little bit about some improvements in contract provisions.
Yes, one of the things that we had focused on, you know, before the creation of the Public Safety Working Group, if you remember, the law innovations. So that was something that we did over a number of years, 2009 to 2013, and continue to be involved with that, with some of the specifications and working groups that have arisen out of that, such as the HUIA specification, the proxy privacy working group, and a few other things. So obviously that's something that touches upon public safety and domain names. The other thing that you see on there is the improvement of HUIA's accuracy. That's kind of where we started, and you're going to hear a little bit about that further from Catherine and Greg later on, insofar as how HUIA's accuracy is important to the work that we all do as public safety officials, and also get kind of a flavor of what Europe does and how they balance European protection laws and also the public safety concerning HUIA's accuracy. So just to, you know, like we said, we've been doing it for 10 years, and it's consistent themes that we have continued to be a part of.
So what the big takeaway for this first section is, even though we're a newly launched working group under the Governmental Advisory Committee, we've actually been active and advocating for quite some time, but now we have a more formal channel of communication or advocacy work under the umbrella of the GAC. So recent work. I want you to know, as Alice indicated at the beginning, that if you're interested in looking at some of our recent work, the GAC website is the place where you can find it. And all of the GAC working groups, in fact, have a public space on the GAC website. You don't need to be a member of the GAC to access that information. Here's a link to our particular site. And the website also includes information about the Public Safety Working Group representatives and various comments that we have submitted. So that's the place if you want to read about it with your own eyes. So we're going to take you through kind of a short highlight session of some of our recent work. Bobby, you want about the 2013 RAA, because I know that's a subject that's near and dear.
Yes, as part of the when the 2013 RAA was signed and it came out, there was a couple of things that came out of it that kind of laid out groundwork for future work, and one of them was the HUIA specification, where that would be reviewed. So this year, during 2015, there was a discussion on how to look at the HUIA's review or the HUIA specification that is part of the RAA and see how it can be improved or changed. So I know ICANN and the registrars had a few issues and comments about it, and there was a public comment period that was open. So we, as the Public Safety Working Group, actually did contribute to the public comments. So we had done that. We had also spoken about the or made comments to the Privacy Proxy Working Group. And I think the last thing was the Next Generation HUIA's that was also open for public comments. So one of the great things about the Public Safety Working Group is that now, as part of the GAC, we're able to focus on these very specific issues. And even though at the beginning we kind of had a disproportionate law enforcement representation, we have kind of opened it up, or it was open, to other government officials that deal with public safety, such as Lorene's agency, which is consumer protection, civil law enforcement, and other public safety organizations, such as the Food and Drug Administration in the United States and its equivalents worldwide, and other such agencies that have impacts on public safety. So that's why you're seeing some of these comments that are being drafted on by the Public Safety Working Group. And I guess the first one we have up there, I'm sorry, is the HUIA's accuracy, which ICANN, prior to the Buenos Aires meeting, had made comments, and the registrars made comments, and we actually even had a public session there. And one of the things that we were interested in is to try to get some more specificity in some of the comments that had come out, namely some of the time periods that were discussed by the registrars and also some of the qualifying language, such as substantial and substantiate. So we were just trying to get a little bit more definition on that and how that would work with specification, because as you're going to hear a little bit later on, that is something that we use, and it is something that we have interest in.
And for a little more context here, the 2013 RAA does have some obligations about registrars having to verify the accuracy of that information and a time period to act if they don't get the verification, if there's complaints, et cetera. Some of the questions we have really focused on the wisdom of lengthening this time period for response, especially if there is no response back from the person who is supposed to provide accurate contact information. Another area that we have submitted a comment on is privacy proxy services, and this was in response to the Privacy Proxy Working Group's report on that issue. And this this service essentially allows entities to mask their information, and there can be reasons for doing so, and there also can be concerns that are raised when that happens. So the Public Safety Working Group submitted a comment on some of the issues in that report. And we drew a line where we thought that there should be a distinction made in terms of the availability of those services. And more specifically, there's a context where commercial services are being offered, i.e., where you, as a consumer, are being asked to provide your financial information, a bank account, a credit card number, et cetera, that you really have a right to know who you're dealing with. Consequently, privacy proxy services shouldn't be available in that sort of situation. We also emphasize that there should be transparency and accountability for privacy proxy service providers, and that when law enforcement makes a request for information about who's behind a domain, maybe the subject of investigation, that those requests should be kept confidential as it's required or permitted by local law, because often law enforcement has an interest in keeping the fact of investigation confidential so that evidence and assets don't disappear. And then we also... Right, that's the wrong device. That shut off my microphone. We also submitted comments on Next Generation WHOIS services, which Catherine's going to be talking more about. That's a really complicated issue, really focusing on what's working and not working now with WHOIS, whether there should be a subsequent system, and if so, a whole host of questions about what that system should look like, who should have access to information. And really what we emphasized in our comment to this preliminary report is that, one, it's complicated, and two, there really needs to be a balance struck, respecting consumer rights and keeping the public safe, and also securing the protection of personal data of internet use. So really are advocating for balancing those viewpoints, being communications open, because these interests are not irreconcilable. Indeed, the Federal Trade Commission in the United States deals with both consumer protection and privacy issues, all under the same roof. We're all friends. We discuss issues with each other, and there's balances to be struck. So that's one of our takeaways, and that will continue to be an area that's very important to us.
So one of the other things that you're going to hear from John Flaherty from the National Crime Agency is the Specification 11, which is the Registry Agreement Security Framework. And that's something that originated through GAC advice in Beijing, so about 2.5 years ago. So we've been working with that, and John has been representing the Public Safety Working Group and working with the registries to come up with voluntary practices, kind of flesh out how that would work insofar as dealing with youth, such as botnets, phishing, child exploitation, so on and so forth. So we have a cooperative agreement with the registries on how we can effectively deal with that abuse and with criminality. So you're going to hear about his work later on today, but just to flag that for now, that's another thing that the Public Working Group has worked on as well.
And future work, what does our crystal ball look like? Well, we're hoping to have representation on the upcoming working group on competition, consumer choice, and consumer trust. That's going to be a very crucial working group to take a hard look at all those very important issues. Besides who is accuracy for domain information, there's also...
Yes, one of the other things that's very important in how we as public safety officials and looking for attribution or looking for abuses, also the other side of the coin, not just the domain name system or DNS, but also the IP addressing system, which is managed by the regional internet registries. And here they are the addressing supporting organization. Outside of ICANN, they are the numbering resource organization. So we're trying to work with them to kind of match up some of the things that we've done here at ICANN with the Registrar Accreditation Agreement and some of the IP accuracy requests so that they would be able to do the same thing. Now, as regional internet registries, there's five of them, so we're trying to work with them to come up with global policies, coordinated global policies with them, so they would have kind of the same voluntary practices to ensure who is due diligence and accuracy as well.
And finally, it is our hope to have more participation from the Public Safety Working Group and ICANN working groups. We also want to focus on outreach to our other government partners, all of the countries up here and in our group have a lot of different agencies with individuals with tremendous expertise on keeping the public safe in a variety of contexts, and those are people who can be important allies and sources of guidance for our group. And of course, our other stakeholders, ICANN, also have a wealth of information and perspective find valuable, so we'll also be focusing on outreach to get the wisdom and guidance from our partners in the ICANN community. So that's a little bit of a snapshot, a highlights reel of the type of work we've been involved in and what we hope to focus on in the future. On those issues, if folks have questions, this would be a fine time to use the microphones that are set to ask them. There'll be other presentations as well, but we thought it would be more orderly to after each presentation.
Thank you, Bobby and Lorraine. If there are any comments or questions, we've got two microphones at the front of the room here. Please come forward. Thank you. Please, your name and
We've been working as a registrar. Important issue. However, there's also the counterpoint to whose accuracy, which is, so I would like to see this working group and to also tackle the patience of whose accuracy to the privacy, how to best protect the privacy data, the private data, who is really what you need, or if differences.
Well, I think you're going to have a lot of those questions answered when Catherine gets to the microphone. She's going to talk about the European data protection and maybe some of the issues or challenges with the next generation and how we balance those things and what might work and what might not work. So I don't want to steal your thunder, but I think that's what we're going towards and may answer your question and address some of the concern.
The point I share with Volker about European, why with the Federal Trade Commission of the United States. But I would like to know a little bit more about the title them to know who you are and know who they are dealing with, why they want to remain private, but at the same time, I want to support their to be able to support people go against vested interests of maybe. The U.S. has always been criticized, perhaps unfairly, about being weak or playing too much to the... So I'd like to know a little bit more about this rationale. That
first, let me say that I understand there are differences of opinion on this issue. And from a consumer protection standpoint, if someone is providing that sensitive information, then our perspective is, we're of course free to disagree with, that we are entitled to know who we're dealing with. And I fully understand the sensitivities about advocacy groups. Advocacy groups can choose to take financial information or just advocate their views. But if they take that step, and they are dealing with that sensitive information, then it's our perspective that the public, that the consumers, have a right to know who they're dealing with. And that's one perspective. We realize that not everyone shares.
Go ahead.
Thank you very much. Mine is not a question, but as much as this is derived, encourage that more members, because with law enforcement within different countries, I would request that... we have more involvement from Uganda.
Thank you. Lee, and then, yes.
Hello, my name is Lee. Dealing with many things, including cybercrime. We have internet pharmacy issues and online drugs. And it's really a point just to say about outreach. June this year agreed on a new declaration. Really here to bring back expertise into...
Right word, Zarko.
Yeah. Thank you, Council of Europe. And we do have a closed meeting later that you're aware of, and you're members of the GAC. So you're welcome, David.
I've got two comments, one specific and one more general. In the opposite way to what you recommended, I've already debated those issues in quite some depth. I understand that you're a new group and have come, and you know, more engagement may be necessary in some of these. And another one is a general sort of comment.
Thank you very much, David. I can assure you, we're not a lobby group. It's yeah.
I understand. All I'm saying is, this is you need to make sure that you're inclusive
yes.
voices within the law enforcement community. Seeking out those voices and worrying about how
that... Those comments very seriously, and we did have that discussion yesterday when we had the discussions with the GNSO, you were present. And one of the issues that came up is that the GAC does need to get involved a bit more earlier in some of the processes, especially the PDP processes. And to that end, we've already started working towards that. There's also trying to understand how governments generally work. We do need to consult at capitals, and we actually do need to consult with various stakeholders. So my apologies if sometimes comments come in late, but we're going to be trying to make sure that we are working very closely with the processes. And to that end, we have members who are going to be joining some of the working groups, so we are contributing directly as a GAC working group. Thank you for those comments.
I understand that I would commend to you all the work that's been done, but the earlier we get it, the better. For everybody, really, even after the initial report, on to our conclusions, which is not.
Bonjour, je m'appelle Amadou Lee.
Hello, I am Amadou Lee. I am a member of the Telecommunications Regulatory Agency in the Republic of Senegal. I commend all these working group members for the work you've done, and I have several questions regarding safety, information or data protection, especially in countries like mine, African countries like Senegal, where to date we have people working in governmental agencies, in public administration, who still use generic email addresses, Yahoo, Gmail, and we do not have enough internet connectivity so as to have a .gov domain extension. We do have members of the government that use email addresses that date their times in college. This is a fundamental issue. Internet today has reached unheard of levels. People handle confidential data in public administration departments, and they don't realize that they're handling that data by using a Yahoo or a Gmail account. Can we protect these people without stopping our work with databases? People that handle important, sensitive databases do not realize that they are handling highly important and crucial data for governments, and this information is hosted elsewhere, and we do not have message handling or management policies, etc. This is even more noticeable when we read people's business cards and we see that they use a Hotmail or a Yahoo email account. So, we do need to know who we work with and who you work with. We need to work with these people that are handling sensitive data and who do not have the necessary resources or levels. So you have to see on the way you can work or what you can do to ensure safety and data protection. We can have firewalls, etc., but if we're not, or if we do not feel safe when we engage in a transaction and we don't know what happens with our data, then we face a big issue that calls for a lot of common reflection, thought, and work in a collaborative fashion with all stakeholders so that data is protected. Thank you.
Thank you. You raise a lot of very important issues, and certainly there's a lot of education that I think needs to happen for the public to know how to be safe on the internet and how to view emails from a Gmail and a Yahoo account, even if someone says they're from the government. I'm not going to be able to answer all the questions you raised because they're such big, complicated questions. But I do know that there is a real need for educating the public to be very cautious when they're using the internet, whether they're buying something, whether they're on a dating site, whether they're getting emails that say they've won a contest, or from someone who is pretending to be in love with them and in need of some cash because an emergency has happened. Those are all very important issues, and I think it's something we all need to be aware of and be working on because people's lives can really be harmed in very bad ways by people seeking to take advantage of them when they're on the.
Do you have another comment or question?
Okay.
The representative from Senegal, continue speaking. Thank you for this answer. Question that I ask myself is the following. In ICANN, we work also with a large companies managing databases such as Google. So what should we do with them? What can we do in a general manner in order to make sure that the databases are managed in safe manners? I agree that the managers are responsible for their actions, but I believe that there should also be a responsibility on all the database managing companies that also host all the transactions. I agree with you that we have to be on the alert, but I would like to know which are the actions or the steps that we could implement in order to give to make sure that we have secure transactions. That was the aim of my question.
The next session, Catherine from the European Commission is going to be speaking about exactly some of those questions and issues you've raised and raised by another speaker. She's going to be talking about HUIs and European data protection laws, which might give us several examples on how we can address the same issues in some of the African countries or other countries for that matter. Thank you. Catherine, please.
Thank you, Alice. Well, I don't know whether I can provide solutions for the whole world, but I'm very glad to see the strong interest in this topic. And as Laureen already said, there's, and as many of you have raised, there's a balance to be struck. And in my experience, these types of debates have always benefited from a solid evidence base. So what I want to try today is just to sort of do a very brief introduction on the EU norms governing data protection. And on the implications that those norms have for processes such as the thoughts about redesigning the WHOIS. And hang on, let me. When I was preparing for this, I look back at the long history that the Who Is discussion has already had, and at accountability in general, and I realize that the history of the discussion on accountability and whether or not we need accountability actually goes back a long way farther. In fact, I found it first mentioned in Plato's Republic 2,000 years ago, where, as some of you may know, there is the story of the Ring of Gyges, which is the story of a shepherd who, tending to his flock, was wandering around the hillside and stumbled upon a cave where he found a ring that, lo and behold, when he put it on, made him invisible. Now, emboldened by this invisibility, he went to the court, laid the king, laid with the queen, and took over the government. And this parable is told in Plato's Republic at the basis of a discussion around accountability, where the somewhat sour conclusion that Plato and his friends drew is that accountability, in a sense, is a moral construct. And as soon as you take away the ability of others to see you, there is no very strong incentive any longer to act morally. So apparently these problems, we're not the first at facing them, and I don't know whether we'll be coming up with a perfect solution. But I don't necessarily think it has to be seen as a trade-off per se. In my work on cybercrime, in fact, I see myself as being on the front lines of data protection because I try and prevent data from being stolen. Identity theft, the theft of payment credentials, the trade in child sexual abuse images, all of these are gross violations of privacy, and we're working very hard to enable law enforcement to be able to prevent and protect and prosecute people for those crimes. I want to sort of represent the views of both sides here. So let me just briefly recap what the law enforcement concerns are with the Who Is. In ICANN's affirmation of commitments, they have undertaken the obligation to maintain timely, unrestricted, and public access, accurate and complete Who Is information, and to review the effectiveness of their Who Is policy every 3 years. And the Governmental Advisory Committee, in its 2007 communique, additionally established a few principles of what the Who Is should do, namely to assist law enforcement in investigations and in their possibilities to enforce national and international laws, to assist in combating against abusive uses, and to assist businesses and others in combating fraud and safeguarding the interests of the public. Now, to go back to the fundamentals, now from a European perspective, data protection and security are both fundamental rights. They're enshrined in the EU Charter of Fundamental Rights in Articles 6, 7, and 8, which basically say that everyone has the right to freedom and security, and everyone has the right to respect for his or her private and family life, home, and communications. Now, the EU Charter is a modern charter in the sense that it already contains rights relevant to digital society, such as guarantees on bioethics and transparent administration, but also something more specific on data protection. So in its Article 8, it does say that everyone has the right to the protection of personal data concerning him or her. It says that data must be processed fairly, and that everyone has the right to access data which has been collected about him or her, and to make sure that that data is accurate. Now, these are key rights in a democratic society, and they are not absolute. So each of those, the rights to security and the rights to privacy and data protection, have to be balanced with each other and with other fundamental rights. Now I just want to briefly highlight the key provisions of our main legal text, which is a directive on data protection, on the protection of individuals with regard to the processing of personal data. What we've heard a lot of concerns in the past about the fact that there isn't a unified voice from Europe basically outlining the concerns and outlining the data protection requirements. And a lot of that is due to the fact that the legislative instrument at the basis of this is a directive, which is a special type of legislative instrument that is binding as to its goals, but it leaves it to the 28 EU member states how they want to implement their own national legislation in order to reach those goals. And that means that we do not have one set of identical laws, but rather we have 28 sets of laws that strive for the same aim, but they do not necessarily contain the exact same language. So that is a challenge. But in fact, we are currently working on adopting a new package, a new legislation on data protection, which hopefully should be passed even by the end of this year, and that will be in the form of regulation. So there we will actually have a law that no longer needs to be implemented in different ways by the 28 member states, but that applies in and of itself right away. So in a sense, you might be getting more consistent answers from the European countries on some of these issues after this has been implemented. So I just want to explain briefly the definition of personal data that we use in the EU. It basically means any information relating to an identified or identifiable natural person. You will note it says nothing about the sensitivity of that information. So really the only key factor here is whether or not you're able to identify a person. So a name obviously is personal data. An IP address can be personal data. It can also be, to take an EU example, a Maltese citizen working for the European Commission in DG X, Y, and Z. That can also be personal information because it is something that allows somebody to identify that person. And again, it doesn't matter whether the information is sensitive, so the concept of personal data does not differentiate, e.g., between content or traffic data or subscriber information. It can all be personal data. The other key concept we have is that of processing. Basically, I have a colleague who refers to this as the Midas touch. Anything you do with data is processing. Whether you look at it, you store it, you delete it, you move it, you disclose it, everything is processing. So what are the requirements regarding processing? First of all, you have to have a reason. You have to collect it for specific purposes. You need to make sure that the amount of data is relevant and not excessive in relation to those purposes. The information has to be accurate and kept up to date. It may be kept no longer than necessary, and the whole exercise needs to be legitimized by a justifying ground. That can be the consent of the data subject or the fact that you need the data for the performance of a contract or a few other reasons. Who are the main actors on data protection? I was just talking about the adoption of the regulation. That will be adopted by the Council of the EU and the European Parliament, which are our legislative actors. I'm from the European Commission, which is in charge of proposing legislation and of monitoring its implementation. Then we have the national data protection authorities, which will be in charge of monitoring the implementation of data protection at the national level, and the Article 29 Working Party, which some of you will be familiar with because they have occasionally submitted comments to various policy processes. They're basically a working group that brings together the national data protection authorities and the Commission in an advisory capacity. So they basically give advice to the Commission and to others on how data protection laws are implemented. And finally, we have the Court of Justice, which is the only institution that is authorized to interpret data protection law. So they're the ones who give us the straight answers on how to interpret the data protection regulation. Now, what does this mean for the who is? We're redesigning the who is. There's three central aspects that we're going to be looking at, both from the law enforcement and from the data protection perspective. The first one is availability. So here, as we learned just now, the data has to be collected for a legitimate purpose, subject to a legitimizing ground. So it has to be collected with the consent of the data subject, for example. And any future registry directorate service should ensure that the purpose is made clear, namely that this is also for accountability purposes, to make it clear to the data subject that this is also for the eventual access of law enforcement agencies. We should collect no more data than is necessary for that purpose, and we should keep it no longer than is necessary. Now, access, the fact that this is currently a public system, and also that ICANN has committed in its affirmation of commitments to the public, that's going to be a key issue to be looked at. From a data protection perspective, the directive does not say anything about limiting access to data. But obviously, from the spirit of the law, it would be helpful if the data was not disclosed unnecessarily. And for the accuracy part, it's actually quite easy, because here data protection and law enforcement are exactly on the same line. Both perspectives ask for accurate data. And that's it from me. I'd be very happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Catherine. If there are any questions or comments, please come to the microphone. Maybe then we can hold any questions or comments and maybe move on to the next session that's looking at case examples of WHOIS, presented by Greg from the European Cybercrime Centre.
Hi, everyone. Can we put the slides on, maybe?
Oh, you have a question. Please introduce yourself. Yeah.
Hello. For the Secretary, thank you for your... A lot of us, many of us, from the WHOIS as it stands now, where the private from the European data protection standpoint, being a cut or a revision of WHOIS as a public safety working group's perspective?
I think that's I agree with you that from an ideal perspective, there should not be open access to all data that's currently available. The question is how to balance that in practice with the needs that WHOIS is there to fulfill. And there is also in the EU legislation, in fact, requiring information to be published on websites, for example, for every actor who's not acting in a strict personal capacity. So if you're not just posting your family pictures for your friends, then you, in fact, not only have to comply with the WHOIS obligation, but you also have to give on your website detailed contact information to be held accountable if anything illegal goes on with your website. So in a sense, also within the EU, this balance has to be struck, and it can go either way in many circumstances. I'm not sure what the perfect system will be for the WHOIS. I don't think anybody is at this point. And we're just trying to basically look at the concerns from both sides and trying to reconcile them here. But I'm afraid I don't have the perfect solution yet.
Follow on. I would like to make sure differentiate between content, which website will. And even there, it goes private purposes that have no publication.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the records. Yeah. Yes, David.
Yeah. David Cake. That's going to be a huge effort. It will welcome, but ask for your involvement. It
would be. Thank you, David. That's the reason why the GAC developed this working group, and we're certainly going to make sure that we are involved. Specifically in some of this, and at the earlier stages, as you say. Thank you. Please use yourself for the records.
Karen Mellon-Tarivo from Mark Monitor. In response to the...
Sorry, are you referring to me?
Yes.
Okay, thanks. Sorry, I wasn't quite clear. I'm not sure where I was contradictory, but what I was trying to present are the two different perspectives on this, which is on the one hand the ideal situation from a data protection perspective, and on the other hand, the ideal situation from a law enforcement perspective. As I was saying in the beginning, these are both the right to security and the right to privacy are fundamental rights from the viewpoint of the European Union, and I think that is shared by a number of other regions around the world. And neither of them is granted in an absolute fashion. So what you have to do in practice is try and strike a balance between them, and that's what we're going to have to do in this policy development process. And thanks again for inviting us and the Article 29 Working Group representatives to be part of the policy development process. I am going to take that back to Brussels, and I'm sure you're also in contact with them, but I'll raise it with my colleagues from the Data Protection Unit again to make sure that they know that we would like them on board, that you would like them on board. And then in that process, I'm hoping that the adequate balance can be found between these two fundamental rights, neither of which is above the other. So where they conflict in practice, a solution has to be found.
Sure. I think that it it'll probably be...
No, I fully understand, and it reflects the current policy as it is. So from a law enforcement perspective, as long as the concerns around a possible tiered access are not addressed, it would be very difficult to have anything else at current. So that's what we're going to have to be looking at in the policy development process.
Thank you. Greg, please. You can. Thank
you very much. I'm going to give you a few examples where the HUIs is useful for cyber investigators. I'm going to represent the law enforcement perspective. Just a few words about the organization I'm working for. Europol is the European Law Enforcement Agency. We are providing support, operational support, analytical support to the 28 member states and the police and law enforcement agencies. On cybercrime, we have established in 2013 the European Cybercrime Center. We do not have executive power. We rely on information that is given to us on cases by the member states and our partners. On cybercrime, for instance, we work very closely with the UK NCA. We work very closely with the Americans, the FBI, ICE, etc. On cybercrime, we have mainly three operational teams. The first one is Point Terminal, who's dealing with online fraud, payment card fraud, etc. Then we have a focal point called Twins, dealing with child sexual exploitation online. And then lastly, we have the focal point Cyber, which focuses on cyber attack affecting critical infrastructure and information system. So that goes from the very basic attack to much more elaborated banking malware and botnets. To set the scene, so I was asked to come up with a few examples that really give you an idea of how the HUIs can be useful for cyber investigation. There are many factors that comes into play when you are trying to solve a cybercrime case. But at the end of the day, I think it really often boils down to attribution. We all know that online there are many products and services that are very easily available to hide your trace online and to hide your identity. There are many examples. I'm not going to list them all. But the point is, in that context, the role of the HUIs is sometimes critical. HUIs is one tool, amongst many others, that the cyber investigators have to overcome the problem of crime attribution. To be honest, most of the top cyber criminals will not fall because they have the right, because of the HUIs, really. They will always use the most advanced anonymity methods to hide their traces. But at least if we have a reliable HUIs that is accurate with verified and validated user data, then we can drastically reduce the scope of the possibilities for criminals to hide their activities. So we need to raise the bar, and I think the HUIs contribute that for the members, for the criminals. It really pushes them to resort to more complex techniques to hide their trace, and that's saying that. First case I want to present to you briefly is a case of a botnet. So I guess you're all more or less familiar with the botnets. I'm just going to say a few words about it. A botnet is a network of compromised computers infected by a malware that allows a criminal to control that network of computers and to issue commands that are the computers then orchestrate various criminal activities. And what the law enforcement is after, of course, is the command and control servers that allows the criminal to speak with net. In terms of botnets and DNS abuse, I think that the abuse, if you're a criminal and you really master the DNS techniques and if you manage to maintain a stream of new domain registrations that keep the botnet fed, then you really have a very robust and profitable botnet. If you manage, again, to get new domain names from registrars around the world at a very fast pace, not only you can sustain takedown requests, but you can also sustain sinkholing attempts and, of course, hijacking attempts from competitors that are also running very powerful botnet. And if they see that your botnet is also very useful, then they will probably want to hijack it. So the DNS technique is very useful for running good botnets. When I was asked to come up with this scenario, I went to the teams of proper investigators because I'm just a police advisor, and I sat with them and we went through a series of cases and they looked at it from the DNS and the HUIs angle. And there was one case, it's a very recent operation, where the Cyborg team was targeting an organized crime group which was responsible for controlling a botnet deploying online banking malware. They were monitoring the group, and then in a private communication between one of the suspects and its accomplice, they shared details on the domain in question. So what they did is they did a simple whois lookup on that domain, and that brought an email address that had been used for registering the domain. They then did a reverse whois lookup on the email address, and that yielded a number of other domains that had also been registered using the same email address. So on those domain names, among those domain names, there was one domain which had been created by the individual in question a number of years ago, and he had used that domain to set up a personal profile, professional profile with CVs and photograph. Obviously, that was before his career as a cyber criminal. So when we used that personal details, we cross-checked it again the national database of the countries in which that person was living, and we found out that that was his real identity. So, of course, further investigation and some time later, we proved that that person was indeed an active cyber criminal, and that led to his successful arrest and conviction. So the main takeaway of that example is that if you have whois data that is accurate, then you can attribute crime much faster than if you don't. And I want to now give you another example, also on the case of a botnet distributing web injects. And that's a negative example, in fact. So one of my colleagues actually spent 3 months recently on an operational analysis report surrounding the activities of also a cyber criminal who was developing web inject to target e-banking customers of banks all over Europe. So basically what it was doing is that once the victim who had been infected by the malware would log on to its e-banking portal, then they would unknowingly be redirected to one of the domains registered by the criminal. And this domain would present the victim with a website very identical to the portal that the person was used to deal with. And then when the victim would enter his banking credentials, they would be harvested by the criminals and used for fraudulent transfers from the victim's account. So what my colleague found is that during over the last 3 months, the person, the suspect, had registered 18 different domains, all for web inject, and targeting customers in Germany, in the Netherlands, and in the UK. And the suspect had used 4 different sets of identifiers to register these domains: names, email, address, and phone numbers. So he did the same technique, whois, reverse whois, and intelligent open source intelligence work on every single identifier, and this resulted to many other identifiers. None of which could lead to any real identity. The point here is that if you have a criminal that does his job properly, between brackets, then you spend very useful investigative time chasing ghosts. My colleague spent 3 months on that case, and he could not find the identity of the guy because the identifiers had been bought off the dark net. They were not legit. They were from identity theft activities. And so you can think that if the registrar at the time took the pain to validate those identifiers, then maybe my colleague would not have wasted that much time and he could have spent his very useful time investigating other cases. So that's just an example to show that when you don't have the accurate data, then we lose a lot of time. I'm looking at the watch, so I will not speak about this one. This is also a very famous botnet that we took down together with the Brits in February. Same story, we wasted a lot of time because the whois information was not accurate on the person we were chasing. But I want to finish up with a positive case. It's a child sexual exploitation case. These are websites that are run by organized criminals, criminal groups. They are not on the dark web, they are on the open web. So you can go on that website. And what they do is that they sell child abuse material online. So basically how it works, that's for a monthly fee of about $99 per month, clients can have access, unlimited access to child abuse material. So what my colleague did was they looked on those websites and they gather the domain names of those websites using open source monitoring and some other techniques. Then they gather the DNS information linked to those domain names, basically the IP associated with those domain names, using tools that are available to the registrars and to any investigator, such as domain tools, API, and so on. And then they gather a third set of data from the WHOIs associated to this identified domain. So in theory, what you get is a domain A has specific DNS information which indicate that that domain is linked to the IP A. Then domain B, DNS information indicate that domain B is registered to IP B, and so on. There's no link between the various domains. But when you start cross-checking the three sets of data, the DNA, the domain names, the DNS information, and the WHOIS data, then they often manage to find one valid email address that is common to all these, those domains. This email is actually used by the registrant to register the different domains, and they need to use one valid email address to communicate with the registrars for billing purposes, for instance. And so the conclusion of that case was that they managed to arrest a group of criminals and to take down those websites. Unfortunately, the business is so good that they keep on popping up. So as a conclusion, again, I will restate a little bit what I've said. I think that accurate and reliable WHOIS data is extremely important for the law enforcement community to address cybercrime. Helps crime attribution, but it's not the silver bullet. If you are a very good cyber criminal, you won't fail because of WHOIS data. But at least it saves precious investigation time. And I think, and that's the, for me, that's the most important, it really raised the bar for the criminals, makes their life more difficult. And I think that's what the law enforcement do very much.
Thank you very much, Greg. We have remote participants, and we have one question. All of GAC Secretariat can read it out for us, or the panelists. Thank you.
Thank you, yes, indeed. Michael Ilishibo. WHOIS is a powerful tool for cyber investigation. However, laws on the part of the registrants normally give accurate names and addresses. Thus, it proves a difficult task during the way that the registrants will and only true details. So I repeat the last sentence. Is there any way that registrants also, how far has Europol gone in ensuring that cybercrime...
Yeah, thank you. Any of the panelists want to respond to that quickly?
Well, very briefly on Europol's capacity building programs. Unfortunately, we're not involved so much in capacity program. We really support the member states' investigations. I think that Interpol has a much broader... portfolio in terms of supporting the capacity building in Africa, for instance, for the cyber criminals. But I think that my colleague from the European Commission has also...
Yes, we do fund capacity building on cybercrime also for the African countries. We've been working for a long time also with the Council of Europe on this. I have the happy news that there's further funding opportunities coming up, especially for African countries, and we're currently looking exactly at that, at cybercrime building. So good news, I hope, for you.
I'm afraid we are running out of time, so I can see we have five people standing to ask questions, so I'll ask them really brief so that we can allow the other speakers to because we don't have that much time in this room. Please, Elliot.
Yes, Elliot Noss from Tukau's. First, you know, I think you did a good job of identifying also in dealing with...
A very quick response. I think that, I mean, I haven't really talked about their relationship with the registrars, but I think the feedback I get from the investigators is that if they have built personal relationship with the registrars, then they tend to get much better cooperation than when they just sent requests that might not be, or, you know, is a lack of background. So that's also something we're trying to do internally to educate our investigators to build relationship possibly with the registrars and more broadly with the private that is holding the key to many investigations, cyber investigations, so that they create good relationship and so that the private sector knows our constraints, what we're after, and then to the best of their ability can provide with the information we need, and not everything, but just what we need.
That's great. Encouraging, and I would describe those as relationships, not presenting this to the CC.
Elliot, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we are running out of time. We've only got 10 more minutes. Perhaps if you could send us the questions, and I think I'll ask all the other speakers to just ask the questions. The questions can be responded to at the end of the session because we are running out of time. Thank you. Please ask your question, but we're not going to be responding to them now. It'll be later. Thank you.
Okay, sure. Thank you for the presentation. I'm still trying to understand. The email address is paramount. But if I get a...
set of data, how am I supposed to know that it's not Catherine? The only way I can do that is by, and often we contact people by phone and say, yeah, yeah, it's Catherine. And of course, we don't know Catherine. How am I supposed, how do you think I'm supposed to further validate what we are already doing, fraud checking, various methods, which I'm not going to disclose, you getting my data? I object opponents getting my data if I'm active, agree to disagree upon, perhaps.
Thank you. We are not going to respond to the questions right now, but you can ask your questions. We'll do that later because we need to allow the other two speakers to present. Yes, please.
You, Ashwin, from Indonesia. Oh, your customer. It means bank should know exactly that the customer European ID card, if you can. Or email, you must know who he is.
Thank you. Yes, please. Name.
Thank you. I think we need to move on because we run out of time, and I think the next will be the UK or PSWGs that have been initiative setting up, and I invite the UK to share with us that apart from the technologies or collaboration works, how the procedures and how we organize in each country, and I'd like UK to share, and we start with Nick Shorey.
Yeah, hello there. Right, so I'm part of the UK GAC team. I share a subgroup focused on the public safety working group activity. Just prior to internet governance, I was a cybercrime investigator, and I'm also a consumer of domain services and utilising privacy proxy services. So I see this issue from all sides. In the UK, like many countries, we have a wide range of government bodies with an interest and responsibility for public safety that extends to the internet. So in response to the launch of the PSWG, we brought together all of these departments to consult on the topics. So who have we got? We have CERT UK, HM Revenue and Customs, who deal with taxation. We have the Intellectual Property Office, the Information Commissioner's Office. We have the Medical Health Products Regulatory Agency. We have the National Crime Agency and UK Policing. In addition to this, we've also brought in the Children's Charities Coalition on Internet Safety, and we have John Carr to my right here. So hopefully that answers David's question about sort of the broad scope of public safety and who we feel sort of irrelevant to this and have tried to get involved. So what is our approach? Now, I think it's critical that governments articulate issues clearly in this area. So my approach has been to involve practitioners. It's the people working the problem and engaging directly with the internet community. Quite often I've found that these practitioners just want a practical solution to a problem. On my left here, we have John Flatty from the National Crime Agency. John is a technical investigator and a subject matter expert, and he's going to speak to you later about some of the work that he's been doing within the Specialization 11 group. We've been holding monthly meetings in London, discussing work and developing consensus recommendations, which then form part of the UK response to the PSWG on this. But I've also noticed it's a great way to share experience and discuss best practice, you know, both for ourselves as government in this area, and how we can work more effectively with the internet community in addressing these issues. I think, as Fadi mentioned this morning, ICANN is just one part of the ecosystem of the internet. And sort of within our internet governance work, you know, we see this as one element of a broader strategy. You know, participating within the Internet Governance Forum and the Council of Europe, you know, as an example.
Nick, sorry to interrupt, but we have 2 minutes left.
We've got so, 2 minutes. Okay, yeah. We've got to speed up. Okay. But we do see this as part of a broader strategy. We're looking then to now going forward to develop sort of day-long workshops And we'd really like to get in registrars and threat response companies to contribute to that. And we do hope that this group can facilitate collaborative engagement across government and the community that constitutes ICANN to develop practical and mutually beneficial solutions. So how can you participate? This is the key thing. You're a member of a government public safety body. You can engage with your GAC representative, who are sort of present here at ICANN. The UK group, we can also facilitate other members of the GAC in reaching out to their respective public safety organisations. I know it can be very difficult to find the right person, so please come and speak to us, and we can maybe facilitate you engaging with the right person. It might be a G7 point of contact or someone from a Council of Europe urgent data preservation list. And if you're in the wider community, again, you can engage with us directly or through the ICANN processes and collaborate on identifying practical solutions that are mutually beneficial. So I think that covers it. Thank you very much.
Okay, Jones, and I think we definitely really are out of time, and then please, I think, sorry, but we have like 1 or 2 minutes left. Okay, sorry.
Right, how fast can I speak? So specification 11, as Bobby alluded to earlier, it's looking at use, abuse issues around domain names. It came about in response to NGPC and GAC advice around ICANN Beijing. The quick update from me is an overview of it. Who's in the working group, what we have achieved and progress to date, and what we're going to discuss this week in ICANN 4. Just to set the scene in terms of what I see as a PSWG registry relationship, when I got asked to be a co-chair in this security framework working group, I said, I've been calling registries for 2 to 3 years now on cybercrime investigations, on UK cases, not with a request for information, but with a problem. And it's usually met with a solution, sometimes from a registry where technical innovation borders on brilliance. So that's the current relationship in terms of registries not having to help law enforcement and protecting the consumer, but wanting to do that. And I say that whilst fully expecting that not every registry is capable of that kind of response. So I think the framework at the moment is already being practiced, hasn't been written down. No? Oh, there we go. So the overview is we're focusing on the use and safeguarding of new GTLDs, GTLD protection, and responding to security threats such as botnets, malware and phishing. The PSWG is on the outside looking in terms of how a registry chooses to respond to such security threats, and we bring, hopefully, best practice case studies to the table this Wednesday in session with registries and registrars to try and see what our engagement is and also post-framework, how we can continue that productive relationship. The working group is formed of practitioners and policy people and compliance managers across registries, registrars and the GAC PSWG working group. We've now got a voice and a seat around the table to try and influence such a framework. The mutual benefit, I think, for all parties is that we increase the threat picture overall, ultimately reduce the uptime of things like botnets, malware and phishing, and reduce that customer harm so everybody can enjoy, you know, the massive social benefits that the internet gives us. So the update so far and progress this week, we're developing a core security framework. We're each going to submit our idea of what one looks like. I'm working on the principle that less is more. It shouldn't be such a very prescriptive framework. It shouldn't go into too much details. It's got to be very flexible, especially at the technical back end in terms of maybe what certain registries are already providing in terms of an advanced monitoring and management policy that they have. We draw on ICANN guiding principles in this process, and they're available in the charter behind this document. Some of the principles are that we must promote industry timely self-regulation to registry abuse, and there is no one-size-fits-all policy. What works for one registry in terms of safeguarding customers might not work for another. So we're collaborating on that existing best practice across registries, registrar spaces, law enforcement experience to date. And finally, the next step is going to be to draft that framework document, set deadlines, with the hope that we can still meet the January 29th, 2016 draft document deadline, which will then be posted for comment. Thanks very much.
So we really run out of time, and then we go on with the issues that interest John Carr.
Yes, can. Okay, I'll try and do this in about three sentences. Obviously, the child protection, child welfare community has got a great interest in a number of the issues that have been discussed already, who is being a very obvious one. But more recently, we became engaged with ICANN when the last round of GTLDs were being created, and in particular the Doc Kids one, but there were similar ones to Doc Kids, where, and again, I think it's a fairly obvious point to make, if you're going to create a space which ultimately will lead to the creation of websites which are bound to attract and are intended to attract very large numbers of children and young people, then it seems to us that there are a number of obvious security concerns which need to be taken account of from the very beginning of the process, and they weren't when the last round took place, and we want to try to make sure that that doesn't happen again should similar things occur in the future. And that's why we're happy to be part of this process in the PSWG.
Okay, thank you. So I think thank you all the speakers, and I think sorry that we really ran out of time, and most of the questions that were asked, I think we will look from the transcripts and then we post the answer into the GAC website. And
You have a quick question that we're not going to respond to now. We'll respond online, but please go ahead and ask, and then we will close because we have been told that we need to get on.
Great. Thank you very much for the opportunity. Wendy Seltzer, very briefly, on the issue of all and signatory of us. So it's a sort of a circular process, but I think drove home that required by the WHOIS.
Thank you very much. I'd like to take this moment to thank the panelists and all of you for the great interactions. And we clearly need more than 1.5 hours for the next session, perhaps 2 or 3 hours. So we look forward to having another public session at the next ICANN meeting. And thank you very much again. Thank you.